Welcome to the Technically Legal Podcast, episode 13 for August 25th, 2009. My name is Ben Snitkoff, and with me today I've got
Dominic Rabier
and David O'Brien.
We've got three great stories for you today. First, Apple, AT&T, and Google have released their responses to the FCC questions that were posed to them a few weeks ago. Second, we've got a cyberbullying mom who was arrested for felony harassment in Missouri. And finally, we've got a case of Redbox, the DVD rental boxes that you see in your grocery store, versus Universal Movies, Universal Home Movies. So to get us started, we're going to talk about the Apple, AT&T, and Google responses to the FCC questions. So to give you a little background, what happened was Apple allegedly rejected the Google Voice application a few weeks ago, which caused quite a stir on the internet, and the FCC, in conjunction with their investigation into exclusivity agreements with mobile phones and wireless carriers, sent Apple, AT&T, and Google a series of questions, essentially asking them, you know, what happened, what are competing applications that were approved, why was this rejected? And there was a lot of speculation as to what the answers were going to be, and I think the answers that we got surprised a few people. So, David or Dominic, quickly run us down, what were Apple's general responses to these questions? You know, what did they say was going on?
Well, Apple's basic response is that the Google Voice application, they actually haven't rejected it. They made a point to say, but they've simply not approved it yet because they're continuing to study it. And they feel that the Google Voice application interferes with the core functionality of the iPhone. Specifically, the way Google Voice works is Google Voice takes care of your voicemail, so it won't show up on your iPhone's voicemail, which would disable iPhone's visual voicemail. There's some other concerns that they had as well, but basically the reason that they gave for not accepting it yet was that they felt that it altered the iPhone's distinctive user experience by replacing the iPhone's core mobile telephone functionality. Basically, Google takes parts of what the iPhone does and replaces it with Google stuff, which disables parts of the Apple user interface that are particularly distinctive about the iPhone, such as visual voicemail.
Right, I think that's a pretty good summary. David, anything to add?
No, not really. I mean, Dominic summed it up very well. Basically, the core problem that Apple seems to have is that it just takes away from the Apple experience that you get when you use an iPhone, and they didn't want to have, or at least they were unsure if they wanted to have an application that sort of took away that experience from the end user.
Right. One thing that I found pretty interesting was that Apple outlined the reasons that it had that it had rejected previous applications, and it included, you know, things that crashed, things that, you know, had sexual explicit content, things that violated the AT&T's user policies, both with Apple and with users. There was a Slingbox had a what they called the Sling Player for the iPhone that allowed people to stream television onto their iPhones. The original version ran over both 3G and Wi-Fi. That violated AT&T's customer terms of service. So when they disabled the 3G streaming, Apple approved it. So you can still download that application, but you can only use it over Wi-Fi now. And most of the other reasons they had, you know, like I said, crashing, it violated Apple's terms of service or AT&T's terms of service. Google, the reason they haven't approved Google's, the reason they haven't approved it did not fall into any of these other categories or any of the other examples that they had given. And, you know, they say they're still investigating it because it's just so strange. People were very surprised with AT&T's responses to the questions. Briefly, what did AT&T say? David,
go ahead.
Oh, well, AT&T basically said that they don't play any role in helping Apple make decisions on what types of apps should be permitted in the App Store. And I think that was one of the key inquiries here, is trying to figure out what exactly is AT&T's role within the App Store at Apple.
Right. A lot of people, including many famous tech bloggers, John Gruber included, speculated that AT&T urged Apple to reject the Google Voice application. And he offered an explanation recently that I found interesting. He said a source had told him that, quote, Apple said, "We didn't reject the application," which Gruber and Gruber's source read, "We didn't reject the application, AT&T rejected it." However, apparently it was meant to be read, "We didn't reject the application, we're still considering it." Dominic, any thoughts?
About the non-rejection rejection or the...
Or AT&T's response, either one.
AT&T's response, they basically said that they weren't involved in the discussions with the Google Voice app, right? And they didn't
right, that's
have
correct.
It. And they did cite a couple applications, Pandora, because they were originally concerned about the streaming music over the 3G network, and I think Apple made some technical upgrades that changed the encoding that made it more possible for the streaming to happen without overloading their network. And also the CBS had a Final Four application where they would be streaming video of the base of the basketball game, and they removed the streaming video over the 3G component and left it in for just Wi-Fi. But other than that, AT&T doesn't seem to have played that much of a role in the Apple App Store apps, just because they, unless it really impacts their network. I guess the impression I got from AT&T's response is their number one concern is the quality of their network, and they're really worried about stuff that slows that network down. And since that, since Google Voice doesn't really impact the AT&T 3G network, because Google, the way Google Voice works is it basically just normally uses phone calls as you would normally use a phone call, it doesn't seem like it would be something AT&T would pay attention to.
Right. That's a good summary. I think... go, David.
It's interesting. I mean, if you read the answers, especially the ones that Apple gave, they were able to present them in a very persuasive way, and they outline sort of the policy considerations that they use when they look at or when they review particular applications. And you might... A conspiracy theorist might even say that Apple was able to sort of construct their answers so that it looked like maybe that there wasn't any antitrust things going on here. You know, we have to sort of take the answers that Apple gave at face value and just assume that everything that they've said here is 100% true. At the same time, though, you sort of wonder, was there other stuff going on behind the scenes? I mean, were there other considerations that took place? Was this really what happened? And did Apple and AT&T consult each other when they wrote their answers?
Right, that's a very interesting point that you bring up. Both of them, both Apple's, which talked a lot about competing products and competing, what's the word I'm looking for, competing applications on the iPhone, and AT&T's, which talked about competing headsets and you know, other carriers introducing their own iPhone killers. They seem to be written to try to dissuade the FCC from thinking that anything anti-competitive was going on.
You're right, and also if you look at the wording of what they use when they're considering various applications, it's very broad. I mean, they can basically consider anything in the end of the day. Apple has left it open so that they can basically reject anything for a number of reasons, and you know, it's sort of more of a subjective standard than it is objective, it would seem, based on what the Apple application reviewers, you know, see in a particular submission.
What I found most interesting here is that the second question FCC gave to Google, asking about what reasons Apple gave for the rejection, is completely redacted because it's confidential. So Google didn't put that in the public response. So we don't know.
Yeah, I agree. That was weird. Considering that of the three companies, I don't know how secretive AT&T tends to be, but certainly between Apple and Google, Apple has the better reputation for trying to keep things under wrap, that Apple would release all of their answers, and Google, which, I mean, presumably would have limited first-hand knowledge of the reasons of rejection, would want them redacted because they were in their memorandum for petition for redaction. They said, you know, these are things that companies typically want to keep private.
Sure, but does it even matter in the end of the day? Because Apple has, you know, provided their answers and they've explained their reasons for rejecting it, and one would assume that that's probably going to be in line with what they told Google anyways, right?
Right. It just seems odd that it is redacted and it isn't listed, because you'd think if it was just in line with what Apple said, then why would it be redacted and confidential?
It is a curious point.
I agree. Any other thoughts on this?
Not in particular. I mean, we'll just sort of have to see where this goes and maybe what Google's next response is to, you know, once all the answers are out there, and we'll have to see if Apple does eventually come around and accept their application. You know, everyone, I think out of all of this, one of the most interesting things, and Dominic mentioned it already, is that Apple came out and said, we did not reject this application. It's still under review. And almost all the press reports were saying to the contrary, that Apple had in fact rejected the Google Voice application. So that's another interesting thing. But again, you know, we'll just have to see where it goes and if in fact the Google Voice application is eventually accepted.
I mean, at the same time, you have to wonder what the distinction is between not accepting it and having it been in, between flat out rejecting it and having it been in this kind of limbo for, you know, 3 or 4 weeks already.
Does Apple have any type of guidelines in terms of a response when you submit an application?
I don't think there's anything official.
You know, it's not like, oh, we'll respond to your submission within X number of days or anything like that, right?
Well, Apple says, or go ahead.
95% of applications get approved within 14 days, but yeah. You know, any number of applications have taken longer than that. Some have been rejected, and then, you know, an email clears up the reason why it's rejected. Some have been rejected, and you have to resubmit, and you have to go through the entire process again. It has been lacking any consistency, which is actually something that Phil Schiller, I have no idea what his current position at Apple is. Phil Schiller, he's been trying to address this. He's been engaged in a series of email conversations with bloggers recently.
Oh, by the way, that 95% figure, I found that to be really fascinating because I've always, from what I've read in the past, based on what developers have said, I always assumed that number of rejection was much higher than 5%.
Oh, no. The vast majority of applications get in. It's just the vocal minority that don't get in or get rejected for stupid reasons or get in and then get pulled that get a lot of press. You got to remember how many applications there are. Yeah, Phil Schiller is the Senior Vice President of Worldwide Product Marketing. He was also the de facto head of Apple for a while Steve Jobs was incapacitated, getting a liver transplant.
Right. And I'm reading here, actually, they get 8,500 new applications and updates every week. So that is a pretty significant number. And it looks like they have about 40 full-time iPhone app reviewers. This is according to Engadget.
That is an incredible number.
That's a lot.
Any last thoughts before we move on?
Nope. I think we've got this one pretty good.
One last question, I guess. So the FCC has finally gotten the responses that they wanted. What are the potential options from here? What could we expect them to do? Just nothing, or would they actually take action? Or,
well, any action that they take. So if they were to do something about this, they would have to issue a series of proposed rules. They would print them in the Federal Register. They would be open to a comment and a notice and comment period for a certain amount of time, so people could read them, respond, make suggestions. The FCC would then have to publish their responses to all of those questions and all of those comments and all of those proposed revisions, and then they could promulgate a final set of rules. So if anything's happening, it is not happening anytime soon, and really, Lord only knows what they'd try to get out of this.
I wonder if, like, these types of responses that are, you know, kind of ambiguous about either what actually happened or they seem to be very one-sided. In this case, it was very pro-Apple, at least it seemed, in Apple's responses and AT&T's responses. And I wonder if that's pretty typical for these FCC inquiries. And, you know, generally when the FCC makes some sort of inquiry into something, if you can almost expect that the companies are going to come back and say, oh, we didn't do anything wrong. These are our policies. These are how we make these types of decisions, and there's no antitrust type stuff going on, and we're not, you know, doing anything funky with the wireless carrier and the exclusive agreements either. So what do you guys think?
I got nothing more. I mean, very interesting points, but I mean, I really, there's no way of knowing where the FCC is going to go with this.
I guess time will tell then.
Right. Okay. So our next story is that a woman in St. Peter's, Missouri was charged with online harassment over a suggestive post on Craigslist. So this is actually kind of a redux of the, not redux, a follow-up to the Megan Myers story. So many of you may remember a girl who had committed suicide, I think it was in 2007 now, after some posts on Craigslist. Lori Drew, the mother...
I think it was MySpace.
MySpace.
Right, MySpace. This story is Craigslist. Lori Drew was recently... her conviction was thrown out by a judge, although we still don't have the full opinion explaining exactly why that conviction was thrown out. After that case, the Missouri legislature passed a law that increased the penalties for harassment, included online conduct to be encompassed under this harassment statute, and increased the penalties for when adults harass minors. And in this case, a Missouri woman was accused of cyberbullying under this harassment statute. She posted a casual encounter ad on Craigslist, giving pictures and the phone number of a 17-year-old girl. And this is a 40-year-old woman who did this. She was arrested for this, which is a felony under the new law. And she was freed on $10,000 bond. So first off, her attorney likens this to writing on a bathroom wall, call Jane Doe for a good time and putting her phone number. Is this really that same behavior?
Well, first things first, actually, I've read the new law, and there doesn't seem to be any express mention of any online activity in there. So this just seems to be an amendment of the actual harassment statute. So even though it seems that everyone has sort of coined this a anti-cyberbullying statute, it can seemingly be applied to just about anything, right?
Right, I agree. There's no specific mention of online activity. I think the way the previous act was written, it didn't include online activity, which is why this was kind of thought of as a cyberbullying statute. But it certainly does encompass that now. Here it says harassment includes communications by any means, which I don't think was included in the previous statute. So,
right, so that's the component then that could. Where you could seek to apply this to online activity, basically. But in reality, though, it's not necessarily a cyberbullying statute. I mean, you could, you know, although it's very relevant to cyberbullying, you could apply it to almost any medium where you have some sort of communication that is effectively harassing another person.
Right.
Anyways, getting back to your question, Ben. Sorry.
What was my question? I don't remember at this point.
Oh, well, you're talking about how... her attorney has likened this to writing on a bathroom wall.
Right.
And I guess what that really raises is the broader question is, does this particular statute, does it pass constitutional muster, in particular the First Amendment? So you can't take away people's rights through these types of statutes to free speech. And the argument here might be that the statute is potentially a little overbroad, and it can sweep in the type of speech that is protected under the First Amendment, because the statute is a little bit broadly written.
So just to sort of explore that idea of the bathroom wall comment or whatever, say that instead of making this posting to Craigslist, this woman had just printed out flyers and posted them all over town with the same sort of thing, for a good time, call, and then the email address, the photos of the girl, her cell phone number, where she worked. Would that be, because that would still fall under the same harassment law, right?
It would. So the statute reads, by engaging without good cause in any other act with the purpose to frighten, intimidate, or cause emotional distress to another person, cause such person to be frightened, intimidated, or emotionally distressed, and such person's response to the act is one of a person of average sensibilities considering that person's age. Whew. That's a mouthful. Dominic, did you get all that?
Yes. Okay. My question was, what difference does it make that this happens on Craigslist, considering the text of the statute does not make a difference, does not distinguish between online and, like, say she had just printed out a poster and put it up all around town with this girl's phone number and photo and everything?
I don't see it making any difference. David, do you have any thoughts?
No, it doesn't. Essentially, I mean, with the statute, the language that the statute says here, it's got two separate components to it. The first says that a person commits harassment by knowingly communicating with another person who is or purports to be 17 years of age or younger, and in doing so without good cause, recklessly frightens, intimidates, or causes emotional distress to such a person, or, and this is the second component...
Wait, I'm going to stop you right there. So I just want to be clear. That section does not apply here because there was no direct communication between the woman who's been charged with the crime and the 17-year-old. So we are really concentrating on the second half. So how about you read that now?
Yep. So the second part is a person commits harassment by engaging without good cause in any other act with the purpose to frighten, intimidate, or cause emotional distress to another person, cause such a person to be frightened, intimidated, or emotionally distressed, and such person's response to the act is one of a person average sensibilities considering the person's age. So it's very, very broadly written. It doesn't specify that any particular medium need to be used.
I guess my biggest problem with this statute is that I think it does in fact encompass some speech that's protected. I could imagine that there's some speech that even if I do it with an intent to frighten someone, it would still be protected speech. Dominic or David, I mean, I certainly can't think of any cases in which the Supreme Court has said that, you know, speech with the intent to frighten is unprotected speech under the First Amendment.
Is unprotected speech? Well, what about the classic fire in a movie theater example?
That's with an intent to cause a panic.
But that's frightening too, right, I guess? Are you distinguishing between intent to cause a panic and frighten?
I'm not necessarily... Maybe. I'm just saying. I mean, as far as the categories of speech that are not protected, I don't think... The categories of, I guess, statements that are not protected, frightening speech, to the best of my knowledge, is protected. I mean... Certainly the latter two categories, speech with the intent to intimidate and this speech with the intent to cause emotional distress, are unprotected. So the state can regulate those. I don't think that frighten is included in that, though.
Right. I guess the interesting thing for me about this case is that her lawyer is making the argument that had her conduct not happened online, she wouldn't be in trouble right now. And I guess I don't understand how he can make that argument considering the statute doesn't distinguish between online and offline speech, whether it frightens or not.
I think his argument is more that people accept as non-harassing for a good time call somebody on a bathroom wall.
Okay.
But people, for whatever, at least this statute is trying to criminalize that same text on Craigslist.
See, I don't find that distinction in the least bit relevant because I think in the same way when you post something online or if you write it onto a bathroom wall, it could still amount to potentially harassing conduct, or the person could eventually be harassed in the end of the day.
Right, but I mean, I've never heard of anybody being prosecuted for writing for a good time call on a bathroom wall. That being said, I have no idea how you would find out who wrote that.
I think that's the problem there. It's like when somebody writes something on a wall, unless you have some sort of evidence that you know that a particular person wrote that on the wall, it's very hard to track down the person who actually perpetrated the act. And where you have something that's online here, I mean, you know, everyone likes to think that they're anonymous online, but that, as we all know, that's generally not the case. You can take a bunch of measures to try to protect your identity online, but, you know, in the end of the day, you still get an IP address logged, and you can potentially trace that back to a person.
Yeah, although there are ways to prevent that from happening too. Although we would certainly never advocate trying to shield yourself from any type of criminal liability. If you have legitimate reasons to want to be anonymous online, you could use something like Tor. That's T-O-R, it's described as an onion router. It basically routes your data through many people who are using that same service in order to help anonymize you. But again, that's only for legitimate purposes. Everyone agree? Only
of
legitimate
course.
Purposes?
Certainly.
Absolutely, absolutely.
anybody else have thoughts about this?
I'm reading this statute, and I'm still struggling to articulate a way where you could find reasonable speech that is definitely protected under the First Amendment. I know that you could probably do it, and someone who is much smarter than me could sit there and figure out a way where you could have some sort of speech which could arguably fall under the language of the statute, but at the same time still is protected speech or expression under the First Amendment. But I'm just not seeing it right now.
Well, no, I mean, it's really, to me, it seems like it's pretty simple. Like, say that this 17-year-old girl, I don't know whether she was or wasn't, say she was overweight, and this lady just made a posting on Craigslist that instead of putting her in the casual encounter section, had just been like, this girl is so fat. And that would cause emotional distress. And without any good cause. I'm sure that girl would be traumatized by that. So, I mean, that would fall under the statute, but that would still be protected speech, right? I mean...
Not necessarily, because if it... You know, that's where you get into the weird area of the privacy torts, and where you're casting somebody perhaps in a false light, or you're, engaging in basically public dissemination of private facts.
I don't think that the fact that someone is overweight is a private fact, is it? I mean, if it's...
No, and plus if it's accurate, it wouldn't be false light.
Exactly. So I'm just trying to come up with an example of that something that falls under the statute and yet would be protected speech. Since the statute covers both frighten, intimidate, and cause emotional distress, it seems to me that emotional distress is the biggest doorway to get through that statute, because a lot of stuff can be emotional distress. And it seems like it doesn't seem like it's too hard to find an overlap between something that's emotionally distressing to someone and yet falls under protected speech, which means that at least the statute partly is unconstitutional, which means it needs to be scaled back in some way.
All right, okay, I'll buy that. And I think you probably hit it correctly, that the emotional distress component and maybe the frightened component too are a little overbroad.
I'm going to have to disagree with you, Dominic. I think that the frightening is the better argument, because emotional distress is regulated by states all the time. I can't think of any states. I mean, and I have not done any type of extensive search, but to the best of my knowledge, most, if not all, states have a law making it a tort to engage in a either intentional or negligent infliction of emotional distress. And if the states can regulate that civilly, they can also regulate that criminally, as long as the statute is. And in here, it's you have to have intent to cause emotional distress, and you have to actually cause emotional distress.
And I think another important part of the statute is the engaging without good cause aspect. But again, I guess my example of the "you're so fat" posting on Craigslist, that seems like it would fall under the statute, right?
Yeah, I agree it does.
But does it seem like it would still be protected speech, assuming it was true and not in a false light? To me, it seems like that would still be protected speech.
Well, see, I think that's what the without good cause clause in there is trying to get at, is that if you have good cause to post something, perhaps, and that's a very ambiguous phrase, good cause. I mean, what is that in the end of the day? I mean, we have a bunch of, I'm sure that there's a bunch of opinions in the law which sort of seek to interpret the phrase good cause, and it could mean a number of different things, but it's very objective, and it could include a number of things. But I suppose that the argument is that if you have a good reason to post it and if you have a good reason to communicate it with anybody else, that it could have, the purpose of the communication is to frighten or cause emotional distress. That's sort of the key component of the statute.
Okay. Anybody?
Sorry,
have...
I had a helicopter go by, so I had to mute out.
Yeah, I was kind of wondering what that was.
I didn't mean to cut that off so fast. This is what happens when you live next to a hospital in the city. So
let's say that the statute is indeed unconstitutional. How does the case proceed from there?
So one of the interesting bits about First Amendment law is that even if she violated the statute, and even if the conduct that she did to violate the statute wouldn't have been protected, it wasn't protected speech, she can still get out of this by saying that the statute was overbroad. But so her attorney would either bring a motion to dismiss at the beginning or a motion at the end of the case and say, you have to throw out the verdict because the statute was unconstitutional and overbroad, and she'd get off scot-free. Scot-free. Okay.
All right.
Any last thoughts before we move on to the last case?
No, I don't think I have any extra thoughts.
Dominic?
Nope.
Okay, the last thing we've got is the Redbox v. Universal case. So, Redbox... Oh, I had to mute for a second. Redbox is a retail... It's a rental service. They're operated by the same people who do Coinstar. You'll see them in chain restaurants and grocery stores. I even saw one in the St. Louis airport recently. It's... big red box. You can rent DVDs for $1 a night. they were previously purchasing DVDs through two DVD distributors. However, Universal, the home movie and the movie studio, did not like Redbox. Did not like the fact that Redbox was renting these DVDs out for $1 a night. Did not like the fact that after 14 days they would sell the previously viewed DVDs for $7, as opposed to the typical 14, 18, however much you see them for. So Universal went up to Redbox and said, here's an agreement that you guys have to sign. And the agreement did several things. First, it limited the number of new releases that Redbox could have in their units. It limited Redbox to only getting these new releases 45 days after their street date. Meanwhile, Redbox would have these new releases now. And it also gave Universal a bigger chunk of Redbox's profit off of renting those DVDs. And what Universal said is they said, you either sign this or we will tell our distributors to stop, or we'll tell, you know, the distributors that you use to stop selling you these DVDs. Redbox refused, and Universal did stop, told their distributors to stop selling DVDs to Redbox. Redbox then tried to get DVDs through other means, but were shut down there as well. So Redbox bought a suit against Universal for two things, antitrust violations and copyright misuse.
So, and also actually breach of, or tortious interference with contracts.
Right, also tortious interference with contract. Good call, David. Recently, the suit was filed in, I think, October, and very recently, Universal partially won and partially lost a motion to dismiss those three claims, the antitrust, the copyright misuse, and the tortious interference with the contract. So, David or Dominic, could you run us through those real quick and tell us, you know, what got dismissed and why?
So I can talk a little bit about the misuse claims. Basically, copyright misuse is a pretty recent topic in copyright law, as a matter of fact. It has grown out of patent misuse, basically, and it's a very uncertain doctrine. In most jurisdictions, it's only acceptable as a defense to a claim against copyright infringement, but the gist of it is we don't want copyright owners to try to control things that are not necessarily protected under the Copyright Act through their copyright. And I know that sounds confusing, but the typical situations where you see it arise is when, say, actually some of the movie production studios have had problems by trying to decrease the number of derogatory comments on websites. And often what they'll do is they'll bring like a copyright action based on infringement for usage of any of their content. And what they're trying to do is prevent people from posting derogatory comments about, say, a movie that came out in the past. And the argument is, in the end of the day, that's not really what amounts to infringement, and the copyright holder is attempting to restrict fair uses in some circumstances of their content. You also see this pop up with licensing agreements and interference of contracts, which is what's at issue here. Now, in this particular case, what has happened is, since Redbox was the party to file the suit, they basically stated a claim for misuse of copyright. Now, in this particular jurisdiction, although in some jurisdictions it is acceptable to do that, in this jurisdiction it's not, and that's pretty well established under case law. So the judge basically granted the motion to dismiss that was filed by Universal and threw out that particular claim.
Okay.
It's important to note that the judge granted the motion to dismiss only for that claim. So the way that a judge looks at it is basically there's four motions, and the judge decides to dismiss or grant each motion in particular individually. So he can grant all four, or he can grant just one or three. So
yeah, the judge actually, if I read it right, also dismissed the tortious interference with contract claim.
Yes.
Right, right. Yeah.
So we'll get to that in just a second. So the next claim, there are actually two claims of antitrust violation. Briefly, what were they arguing? What's the gist of Redbox's claim here?
Well, basically, what Redbox is saying is that Universal has attempted to create a restraint on trade by forcing the distributors that Redbox is using to stop distributing movies unless Redbox agrees to the terms. That's sort of the underlying claim there. I think it's a little bit more complicated, though, because you've got three parties that are involved, and it's a little bit unclear based on the facts what Universal is actually saying to the distributors. All that we really know is what has popped up in the allegation of facts that were filed with the complaint. They framed it in an interesting way, and possibly a pretty incorrect way, too. But and this is sort of a technical argument, but in the complaint, they had framed their antitrust complaints based on the form of analysis that a judge is supposed to use when evaluating antitrust claims, not necessarily on the antitrust acts themselves. But what the judge did was he acknowledged that what Redbox was pleading was done incorrectly. There are still some claims there that were viable, and he permitted them to go forward. Maybe one of you guys can explain that a little better. But
basically, the way antitrust has its own little quirks, and they were basically trying to argue parts of the analysis and using the analysis step as a claim, which isn't exactly technically correct, as David pointed out. But the judge basically saw what they were trying to do, and they did it more explicitly elsewhere, but they were kind of throwing everything into their boat. And so he picked out the stuff that mattered and said, all right, you guys aren't doing this technically right, but over here you've got the right idea with regard to antitrust, so that he denied Universal's motion to dismiss the antitrust claim, which means that the antitrust aspect of this case will proceed, and it remains to be seen how it will be resolved. But Redbox does have an antitrust claim that's viable against Universal Studios.
One of the things that the judge pointed out was that these commercial boycotts, so let me take a second to describe the difference between a commercial boycott and a non-commercial boycott. A non-commercial boycott would be if a bunch of people get together and say that they're going to stop going, they want to stop using Whole Foods because, say, the CEO of Whole Foods came out against a public program, a public healthcare option. That would be perfectly okay. Individuals have a First Amendment right to association and a right to speech, and they can organize as much as they want to not buy these type of things, to do those boycotts. Commercially, you can't do the same thing. Commercially, let's say you've got a bunch of construction workers or construction companies. They can't get together and organize and say that they will no longer be buying lumber from Home Depot or Lowe's or any of those big places. That's illegal under the Antitrust Act. That's an unlawful restraint on trade. I'm not entirely sure why that distinction exists, but it exists, and it is as close as we're going to get under modern analyses, in my view at least, to a per se violation of the antitrust law, where you don't need to go any further. You don't need to, you know, look to see how much market share they had. You don't need to see what the effect on the market's going to be. You just know it's an open and shut case that it's going to be a violation of the antitrust laws. One thing that it's been a theory of mine that the court being the Supreme Court here in antitrust cases, has been moving further and further away from these per se analyses. It used to be that there were a lot of categories of antitrust violations that as soon as you saw a specific fact pattern, you knew for sure that it was going to be an antitrust violation, and the court wouldn't go any further than that. It seems in recent years they have been moving further away from that, where each and every antitrust case, you have to look to see what kind of market share there is, you need to see what market they're actually in, and you need to see what kind of effect it will have on the market.
Right.
Have you guys been seeing that same trend?
I've definitely read about it, and I do know that the court has been reluctant to continue with sort of the aggressive per se analysis approach to antitrust claims.
Do you guys want to fill in for our listeners the difference between the per se and rule of reason analysis and the quick look analysis?
Okay, yeah, I'll do the best that I can. A per se analysis, a case where you used to see a lot of per se analyses going on were what are called tying cases. Let's say I make a machine that salts driveways, and I sell you that machine and say you can only use this machine with my brand of salt. That's a tying agreement. I'm using your purchase of my machine that salts things to also tie into it and lock you into purchasing only my brand of salt. And it, that used to fall into a per se analysis. Now the court would probably do this rule of reason analysis where they'd go through step by step and they'd see if I had market control, if I define what the market was, in this case machines that salt things, or some similar market, figure out what the market share was, and if I effectively leveraged my monopoly in, if I had a monopoly, in that salt machine market into, and leveraged that monopoly into trying to get a monopoly in the rock salt area. The quick look is kind of between that and the rule of reason. So I'm going to go to the rule of reason next. The rule of reason is this other analysis that I've been talking about, where you go, you know, step by step, you look at, you know, every element of this, and you look at, you know, what the market is, whether or not they have market power, all the way down. It's a very, very in-depth and complicated analysis. Was somebody trying to jump in?
Nope, go ahead.
Okay, and the quick look is between that, where you take a, I mean, the court never did a great job of defining what this test was, but it's essentially in the middle. You take a quick look at it. You see if it looks like it's antitrusty, and if it is, then you go with it. But if it doesn't look antitrusty, you kind of let it slide. Do either of you have a better explanation of the quick look, or?
No, that's pretty good. I mean, the boundaries, unfortunately, are really blurry in this area. Like, courts, like you said, have never really done a great job of saying this is where you use quick look, this is where you use that. It's all kind of just fuzzy in that sense, which makes it unfortunate, but it law professors enjoy writing questions on exams because it's so fuzzy.
Right. So I guess the last thing that we have to talk about in this is tortious interference with contract. This is by no means an area that I have much experience in. Do either one of you two want to take over that and maybe go through the elements with us and then explain the court's reasoning as to why they dismissed it?
If you give me a second, I could do that.
Okay.
Basically, tortious interference with a contract, the claim requires that there has to be some sort of valid business relationship, and that a third party has to come in and sort of interfere with that relationship. They have to be aware that the relationship is there, and the interference that they're doing has to be intentional, and it has to eventually induce or cause some type of breach of that relationship and effectively cause damages in the end of the day. In this particular case, the argument is that Universal is coming in and, by leveraging themselves in the way that they have, they're interfering with the relationship between Redbox and the two distributors. So this, I mean, we've gotten lost a lot in the law, I think, in this throughout the course of discussing this story. But what they seem to be saying here is that the actions that Universal took basically put Redbox and the two distributors in a very tough spot, and they're arguing that it caused some sort of breach of the contract. Now, what the court did in this case, the judge actually said, and I think I'm going to read it here, that the contract which Redbox presented to the court to evidence that there was some sort of contractual relationship between Redbox and the two distributors actually belied the claim that was asserted, meaning that the contract itself didn't actually govern the circumstances that Redbox claims that it does. And what Redbox was saying was basically it would have needed to have some sort of unconditional transaction that went on. So notwithstanding anything else, there had to be like an unconditional requirement that the distributors would always give the DVDs to Redbox. And that wasn't the case in the particular contract, so it was also dismissed.
Yeah, that sentence in particular struck me as strange. That was never my understanding of tortious interference with a contract, that, you know, the tortious conduct has to be totally antithetical to the contract. Because the contract didn't include a phrase that said you will always give us Universal DVDs, that the claim wasn't viable.
Yeah, you know, I agree too. I had always been under the assumption that it was a little bit different. You just needed to sort of interfere with the relationship itself, and assuming that was the case, or at least that was my understanding, that it seemed that Redbox would have had a much stronger claim than they actually did, or at least than the court actually decided that they had.
Right. Any other thoughts on this?
Well, I mean, we could talk a little bit about what Universal is actually doing here. Essentially, they seem to be trying to entirely foreclose a market of cheap DVD rentals for a period of 45 days. And I've read a couple of other commentaries from just regular tech journalists, and their take on it is that this is a huge market, and one of the strongest selling points that Redbox has is that a person, when they go to a store, they see the Redbox thing and they decide, oh, hey, look, cheap DVD rentals, and they could get it a DVD cheaper than they might get it at Blockbuster or Hollywood Video or any of the other competing brick-and-mortar type stores. And it is sort of taken a hold of this small chunk of the market and created a way that you could distribute DVDs really efficiently at point locations. And by requiring a 45-day wait limit, I think what Universal is trying to do is to, you know, take that option away from consumers, because if you can't get it immediately at one of these Redbox units, then why wouldn't you just either buy it direct from another Universal DVD distributor or go to one of the brick and mortar stores and rent it there, which would in turn get the DVDs quicker when they're released.
Right, I agree with your analysis there. Universal doesn't like the fact that people are getting these cheaper than other places, and specifically, at least my guess would be that they're getting these used DVDs so quickly and so inexpensively. That, you know, they're flooding the market 14 days after release when other preview DVDs are from, you know, Blockbuster or Hollywood Video just don't get there that quickly. In the end, though, I think that Universal is shooting themselves in the foot.
Maybe, but you know what? These guys are pretty smart. Their whole business model is trying to maximize revenue. I can almost guarantee that someone sat down and did the cost-benefit analysis, and they realized that there was a good chunk of revenue that they could get even if they did this. If they were able to successfully prevent Redbox from distributing DVDs in this manner. And I don't think we mentioned it yet, but the Redbox model is basically a $1 a night rental. And then if you keep it, I believe, past a certain number of days, you essentially buy it for $25. And then you can also purchase the used DVDs from the units themselves for, I think, $7. You probably mentioned this, Ben. I think it's $7 a DVD.
Right. And that's 14 days after it's released. I mean, I will say, I'm sure somebody did the math and they decided that this wasn't a good thing for them. But as I alluded to in my post about moral panics in the copyright wars, these companies rarely know what's good for them in the long run. That book, Moral Panics in the Copyright Wars, goes through each and every major development in musical technology and accompanies it with the testimony that somebody gave in Congress or the articles that somebody wrote somewhere saying how this is absolutely going to destroy music. And that goes literally from the player piano to phonographs to digital audio tapes to MP3s till today. I think this is a boon for consumers, and anything that is a boon for consumers is going to be, in the end, good for the copyright holders and the producers of that.
Well, interestingly, I think historically you see consumers find a way to sort of route around the damage that's been done by these the content owners themselves, and so maybe to some extent this actually induces infringement in the end of the day. You know, it encourages people to find alternative cheap means of getting the content on DVDs that they want.
See, but Redbox isn't doing any sort of infringement. Everything they're doing is legal, and I thought it was interesting in the decision to read about how they would actually go to stores and buy DVDs and put them in their their Redboxes. And sometimes, apparently, some stores got word of this, and they made their employees check if someone was working for Redbox and forbade them from selling DVDs to them.
Yeah, I don't know if there's any proof of that, essentially. Yeah. I'm not... Not to knock you down there, but I don't know how much proof there is about...
It seems pretty cloak and daggerish, as the judge did. And just as a trivia note, the decision itself, if you read the facts section, and it'll be linked in the show notes, the judge has a little bit of fun with movie titles in the facts section, which you may find amusing or incredibly annoying.
Incredibly annoying.
Right.
This is what happens when judges get bored, I guess.
Yeah, and some judges do it very well, and some judges don't.
You'll just you'll just have to read it, and then you'll understand what we're talking about. But needless to say, I found it a little bit annoying. I don't think it was really done very
seamlessly.
It got
old fast. So.
Yeah.
Okay.
Anyway,
if nobody has anything else, one last chance. Speak now or forever hold your peace. Okay. were you about to say something, Dominic?
I was going to say I have no objections to this union, but...
Okay. David, you good?
No, I think I'm good, thanks.
Okay, in that case, I would like to thank you all for joining us. You can visit our website at www.technicallylegal.org. If you have comments, questions, story ideas, please email us at podcast@technicallylegal.org. My name is, signing off, I guess, my name is Ben Snedkoff, and with me today were...
Dominic Rabier.
And David O'Brien.
Thank you for listening.